Welcome to the Workflow Show. I'm Merrill Davis alongside with my co-host Nick Gold, and it's episode 204, and it's a big one, the Mac Pro. It's here.
Merry Mac Pro Day to each and every one of us.
Merry Mac Promis?
Something like that.
Yeah. Today, as of this record, we are sitting here on the very first day of the new Mac Pros being available.
Well, quasi-available. Apple has finally decided to take orders for these new tubular Mac Pros, and we have all of the pricing. We can put orders in. First thing I'm going to just throw out there, folks, be patient on this one. Like the days of yore when Apple introduced new Pro workstations and it could take a month or two for them to arrive, this is going to be a similar circumstance. These things are going to be highly constrained. Apple's actually assembling them in Austin in the United States of America, and it's a new manufacturing facility. The parts are going to be constrained. So if you get your orders in, just be patient. They will arrive, but it's probably going to be late January or February timeframe to be sure.
So it's pretty exciting. You know, they're manufacturing these in the U.S., and then, of course, there's an Apple Care Center that was just opened up in Pennsylvania. So the East Coast contingent of Apple is a little bit stronger now, too. And I figure let's just get to the meat of it. Let's talk about this bad boy.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the funny thing is Apple decided to do something a little atypical a few months ago and essentially unveil the machines and paint a portrait of what the possible specifications will be. But now we know how they price, what the true set of options are, and you know, it's not really taking us by surprise because we knew what the variables were going to be in these Mac Pro configurations. But you know, it feels a little more real now. It's getting real because now we can actually put orders in and people will have to make these decisions and decide, is this the Pro machine I've been waiting for? And if so, this is how much I budgeted for it. And out of the available options, what do I want to get for my money? These things, you know, in some ways, they're a lot like an iMac or a Mac Mini in that we don't expect there to be a lot of aftermarket upgradability. So while this may end up not being true, it's probably best to assume that the machine you order, maybe with the exception of the RAM configuration, that's going to be the machine that's going to be there in front of you until you get a new one, because we're not expecting you to be able to do CPU upgrades, graphics processor upgrades, and probably even storage upgrades. You know, the one thing that's clearly user replaceable is the RAM. And so this is going to be the machine that you're with. So you want to make sure you spec it out appropriately.
And to add to that, when we're talking speccing it out appropriately, the things to think about. You are currently working in a 1080p workflow, and you don't even have a 2K camera, a 4K camera, but you might just in 2 years. But the idea is to spec something that you can really sort of anticipate what your needs are. 4K is a reality, you know, from a consumer perspective, from a professional perspective. There are 4K monitors that are compatible with the new Mac Pros, and Nick will talk a little bit about them in a second. But what are you anticipating the kind of workflows that you will have? If you need to natively work in those larger formats over time, you might want to bump up that GPU acceleration to 6 gigs out of the gate, because 3 gigs might just work for you now until whatever the new camera codec is that you receive for the camera that you purchase a year in the future.
It's really true. I mean, we typically are trying to recommend to our clients, you know, build headroom into these types of things because, you know, digital media is changing very quickly. We obviously went through the standard def to high def, you know, transition, and now it very much seems like 4K could be a reality, if not for delivery, at least for camera acquisition. And, you know, even if you're not planning on delivering 4K, shooting in 4K, even if you're down-rosing to HD, leads to some just very gorgeous-looking HD footage. But also, you know, think about it. With a 4K frame size, that's basically like four 1080p frames all put together. And so in the post-production side of things, if you're shooting in 4K, it's kind of like how with still cameras, we have these very high megapixel counts. But one thing that those extra pixels gets you, even if you're, you know, distilling it down to a significantly smaller picture, is you can crop and still maintain a huge amount of quality. I think a lot of people who are used to shooting in HD are used to kind of thinking of everything that the camera is picking up is going to more or less be on screen. But if you're shooting in 4K, you can do pan and scan, you can do cropping of the frame, and basically buy yourself a lot more wiggle room and be able to manipulate that content in post-production and really just zoom in on the portion of the overall 4K frame that is what you want there in the frame, and 4K buys you that in post, whereas with 1080p or 720, you really don't have that extra room around the center of your frame to work with. So, you know, these are things that are just going to start to become a reality. And a lot of people said, oh, well, I do video for the web mostly, and I'm never going to need HD. And just look at the last few years. I mean, nowadays, most video on the internet seems like it's HD frame size. And so,
and 4K is coming to YouTube, you know, so that's a reality. And 4K is already committed by Netflix for 2015. I mean, it is going to be a part of our consumer landscape inevitably. So that 2-year cycle prior, that's when the professionals really got to put their toe into the water, I think.
Yeah, and again, remember too, listeners, that whenever you see this phrase Ultra HD bandied about, that's just a kind of more consumery way of saying 4K, right? So Ultra HD, 4K, it's all really the same thing. You know, many of the cameras that are coming onto the market now are 4K cameras. Red's had ones that are larger than 4K frame sizes for a while. Blackmagic's got them coming out. You know, there's quite a lot happening in this space, and the technology is just going to inevitably get cheaper and cheaper. So yeah, this is why we recommend build some headroom into your machine. You're not exactly sure what kind of load you might be throwing at it a year from now, 2 years from now. And you know, most of our clients, as you can attest, Merrill, they tend to hold on to their production workstations. I'd say the average is somewhere between a 3 and a 6 year cycle, right?
Yep.
And if you really are, you know, thinking, well, gosh, what kind of projects might I be working on in 4 or 5 years? You know, well, we're talking now, I mean, literally about like 2018, 2019. It kind of sounds like the far
almost
flung
the
future.
Year 2020.
I know, right? And so it sounds like it's way far off, but I know as I age, man, you blink and like a few years go by.
My kid's already a year old. I mean, like,
I know.
It's crazy. You know, I thought now would be a good time just to go over my short list in my head of nicknames that I have for the Mac Pro, just so we could get them out of the way. Have we figured out what we're calling it officially? I love R2-D-Tube. That's my favorite.
Oh, R2-D-Tube. I mean, folks probably remember that Apple had the Cube, and I think I mentioned this in a previous episode that one of our clients said, well, if they had the Cube, this is like the Tube. And it is basically a little black tube, and it's little, guys. I mean, it's like 1/8 the volume of these big silver Mac Pro and Power Mac G5 boxes that I guess have been kind of the norm for Mac Pro enclosures for, what, like 11 years now or something?
There's got to be like some landfill in New Mexico that's just filled with the chassis of Mac Pros.
We have a tower of empty cases in our
office. We have a tower of towers.
I know. We talk about, like, should we turn these into, like, fish tanks?
Nobody ever does.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. There are a million Mac Pro coffee tables that have never been made.
I know, right? So let's talk about the specs and what the options are and how people should evaluate these specifications based on the type of applications that they're using, the type of projects that they're working on, again, now and maybe down the road. And there's four, and we'll list these out and have a little dialogue about each
sure.
of them. But the other thing that I wanted to just put out there is, you know, up until today, we only knew what the entry-level versions really cost. Apple had thrown some MSRPs out there of basically $3,000 and $4,000. And we knew that those were like kind of two of the lower-end models. If you absolutely max out one of these new Mac Pros, it is around $9,000. So, but that's totally maxed out. And frankly, quite possibly overkill for the vast majority of users. So there's,
but also really commensurate with what the last go around was anyway. You went full bore on an old Mac Pro. You'd be up there too. So you
it's
know,
true. It's true.
It's probably from a pricing perspective on par with what we would expect to see for the product. But you know, unless you're doing some really, really intensive work, it'd be hard to make a case. I mean, we'd love to sell you a 9K Mac Pro, but you could get away with doing something a little less.
So there's four variables when we configure a Mac Pro, right? And these are basically the four modifiable specifications that when we do a custom build, and most of our customers are always doing a custom build of a machine because Apple only gives one or two models as kind of the base models, and everything beyond that becomes what we call a build to order. So there's basically four variables. We'll hit them one at a time, but the four are CPU, GPU, storage, and RAM. That's it. That's what lives inside of this little black tube. CPU, your processor, GPU, your graphics cards, and in the case of these new Mac Pros, it's two graphics cards in each and every one of them. Storage, of course, which is a new type of storage technology. We'll talk a little bit about that. And RAM, the random access memory, your memory, and we'll hit all of these. So let's start with the CPU. It's a little different than what we've had for a few years.
Sure. And probably if you're looking at the first thing you'll notice if you look at those processors and how many cores they are, is that there's an interesting correlation with the speed of the processor and the number of cores.
Absolutely. And this has always been the case, right? So, you know, the first thing about these new Mac Pros, Mac Pros and even the G5s for many years were dual processor machines. They had two physical CPUs sitting on the motherboard. And then for years now, those CPUs themselves have had multiple cores. But then you have two of these central processing units. And these new Mac Pros are different. They only have a single CPU. There is no option for dual CPUs. And the way that it now works is even a single CPU configuration can be a 12-core CPU on one chip. So it's no longer 2 6 cores. It's one chip that has 12 cores. And of course, the other thing, because for years now, again, these Intel processors have a function called hyper-threading. When you like go into Activity Monitor in Mac OS X and you look at all of the cores and their activity across them, each of the cores actually behaves as if they are two cores per core. And this is what we might call a logical core. Because of this hyper-threading feature, it can kind of treat a core as if it's two cores and do twice as many instructions per cycle. So the four core options are a 4-core chip, a 6-core chip, an 8-core chip, and a 12-core chip. And these are the first times, I think, we've ever had single chips with 8 and 12 cores on a single chip. But you were absolutely right. As you were saying, you know, and this is kind of the trade-off when a company like Intel is building silicon processors, is that as the core count goes up, the clock speed of the chip goes down overall. And so the 4-core, the 6-core, the 8-core, and the 12-core, well, interestingly, from a gigahertz rating, it actually goes the fastest one per core is the 4-core machine, and then it builds up to what is technically the slowest one per core, which is the 12-core machine. So here's the dynamic, right, how this plays out for users.
I'm an end user, and I don't understand. I want 3.9 gigahertz because that's my fast computer.
Well, it's funny, right? And we always look at, like, the battle of the specs, and, right, like,
sure,
the biggest number always wins. But this is an interesting dynamic because if you want the biggest number in terms of speed per core, you're actually doing the lower core chip. And if you want the highest core count, the speed of the chip is going to be lower. So it's like, gosh, which big number do I want? And, you know, the reality is for most people, I think you're going to want to be somewhere in the middle. You're going to want to balance between the clock speed of the chip and the core count. And I think that means for most of our users, they're going to be looking at the two mid-range price options, which are the 6-core and the 8-core chip. Again, those are going to act like a 12-core and a 16-core. But that's how it's kind of been with these chips all along. For years now, they've acted like they have twice as many cores as they really
have. So does that mean the 12-core really acts like a 24-core?
Yeah, if you open up Activity Monitor and you do the little view that shows you every core that's working, it's not 12 bars if you have a 12-core chip. It's 24 little bars that it shows. And then when you're running your applications, you can see those little lines bounce up and down, and it'll show you what the activity is across all of these, you know, not necessarily literal cores, but these logical cores. So let's relate this to the software that people use so they,
sure,
they can make a choice, right? When we talk about cores, you know, think about parallel processing, the computer's ability to handle multiple tasks simultaneously, right? And in the world of computing and in programming, we refer to these tiny little tasks that are running in the background as threads. That's what they're called. You know, that's what's being kind of processed as you use your computer for various tasks. You have all of these little threads going on. And so the language we use to describe applications and programs that are very capable of taking advantage of multiple processor cores simultaneously is they're multi-threaded, in that one program that you're running, say After Effects, can actually spawn multiple simultaneous parallel processing activities across all of your real and kind of logical cores, and it really will take advantage of the more cores you have, the more it can be processing in parallel. And even if you run applications that don't have a whole lot of multi-threadedness going on, and that they really maybe only take advantage of one or a couple of cores at once, well, keep in mind, you still have multiple things going on the computer. You've got the operating system. That might have many threads going on all at once. You might have several programs running easily all at once. For you Adobe users, it's going to be very common to have both Premiere and After Effects running simultaneously.
Photoshop open too. I mean, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. All of our creative users, they typically have, like, you know, a good range of pretty hardcore creative applications open all at once. And so, you know, different apps may, to a greater or lesser degree, be more or less multi-threaded. But when you have multiple apps open simultaneously, you're inherently going to get a benefit the more cores you have. But there is this flip side, in that the clock speed of the cores, each core, is higher if you have a lower overall core count. And what that basically means is, you know, if you think of the clock cycle of a CPU as just how many little bits of work it can do per second or per minute or whatever range of time you're talking about, even though you have a lower core count with that 4 or 6 core versus the 8 or the 12 core, it's able to cram more work in because the chip is operating at a faster clock speed. So again, it's like you have to balance, you know.
It's almost a 6 and a half dozen the other if it depends on, you know, the workflow.
And the reality is, if you look at the clock speed differences between the 4 different chips that are an option, and you look at the core differences that are, you know, the options, again, ranging from 4 cores to 12 cores in a single chip, you do have to balance this. If you use applications that are very good at taking advantage of multiple processor cores, you know, typical media transcoding programs are very good at that. You know, After Effects is typically quite good at taking advantage of multiple cores. In fact, most modern software is. And the reality is, most people's workloads will typically be improved these days more by having more cores available to them. Do I think that the 12 core, given that it's priced at this quite a premium price level, I mean, I think it's about, it's at least $1,500 more than the next one down, which is the 8 core machine. Do I think that's absolutely necessary for everyone? I don't.
No, and that's always been our advisement historically, is watch out for that first fully populated, fully full max Mac Pro. If I were to make this purchase myself, if I were to just say, and this is something I'm actually considering because I very much like one for my own work, if I were to do that, I probably would land on an 8 core with 512.
Well, we'll get into the other specs,
all that stuff,
in a moment,
right? But yeah. I would land on an 8 core because that would, for me personally, that would be the difference, the nexus between the kind of speed I wanted and ultimately the overall price, right?
Yeah, and the other thing to remember too is that, you know, Intel is the largest CPU fabricator on the planet. These are Intel chips. But for Intel to be able to create slabs of silicon that these CPUs are built on, and have them and pump out a chip where all 12 cores are functioning fully properly, it is so much more difficult and expensive for them to do that versus one that has 8 good cores or 6 good cores or 4 good cores, that they have to charge a super premium, typically for that highest end option. And I mean, for a lot of years now, I've typically recommended to clients, get the second one down when it comes to CPUs. Because, I mean, if you need all the power you can get and money is no object, and
go for it.
If that's you, you're my favorite customer.
Call us, please.
Yeah. But
now.
But we like the rest of you too. It's okay. But, you know, okay, go for the 12 core. But again, the cost benefit analysis that you should be running is, you know, is it worth that much more of a premium? Or if I bump it down to the 8-core, given that the 8-core is actually a bit faster, the 8-core is a 3 gigahertz versus the 2.7, which is the 12 gigahertz. I'm sorry, the 12-core is 2.7. So it's like, that's an awful lot of money to get, you know, 4 extra real cores. And I think most people will be pretty well served with the 8-core. And frankly, even the 6-core is a very powerful machine, and its clock speed is higher still than even the 8-core. So, you know,
I'd say you got to the core of the issue here, Nick.
I see what you did there.
And also, it's important to look at, like, you know, the iMac specs. And if you stand them up alongside, you're still blowing them out of the water.
Yeah, and the other thing to remember, too, is that these are the latest generation Intel Xeon chips. They are the high-end workstation and server-class chips that are overall, frankly, more reliable than the CPU class that's in an iMac or the other Apple products. I mean, those are good chips, too, don't get me wrong, but Xeons are specifically built to behave good under load.
They go in a lot of servers we sell, and you know that's a server class chip at the end of the day.
Yeah, and again, high end creative workstations tend to use Xeons. And one of the differences is, let's say you're there in that project, and it's this massive, long, you know, After Effects project with, I don't know, you know, dozens of layers of graphics and transitions and whatnot, right? And you there, you got to do a render. And that render is going to take like 4 hours, 6 hours. Well, for that whole time where you're doing that final render, this machine is working hard. It's getting warm, and computer parts typically don't behave quite as nicely when they heat up a bit. And Xeons are really built to stay reliable and get the render done, for instance, if that's the task that you're throwing at it. Or if you're doing a long video ingest and you're transcoding something to a different format from some ingest you're doing, you know, the Xeons typically will hold up much better than a consumer class chip just because they're designed to work under load being used very heavily. So yes, we've gotten to the core of it, haha.
Yuck, yuck, yuck.
We could even make an Apple joke there. I mean, Apple.
Yeah, we got to the Apple core. There you go.
So
moving on to the next part here. So we got the cores. We got the processor speed. That was a lot of the hubbub.
But there's a different class of processor in these than we're used to as well. But it's not a central processing unit.
It's a
graphical processing unit.
GPU.
The GPU. And this is a whole
new
world.
It's
man.
A new buzzword. I mean, last year and the year before, you might remember the conversation when it had to do a lot with After Effects workflows, the word du jour was CUDA core. CUDA, right?
So, yeah, let's break this down a little bit, right? So GPUs, the graphics card that's built into the computer, we're not talking about the video card like an AJA or a Blackmagic card. We're talking the graphics card. You know, for many years, people were like, well, yeah, that's just what I plug my monitor into so I can have video and the computer stuff on my screen, right? And what's changed a lot over the last few years is the ability for creative software, as you were saying, to use the graphics processing units in addition to the CPUs to do renders, real-time preview of effects, all the stuff that our creative applications are using.
I guess it's like
using
a mini CPU just dedicated for...
The reality is it's actually kind of a mega CPU, because the funny thing is that graphics processors have, in general, greatly outpaced CPUs in terms of the improvement that they see generation after generation after generation. And so this is the first time I can ever remember, and considering the first Apple computers I used were in kindergarten, I feel pretty good saying this. This is the first time Apple has out of the box included what is considered a true workstation class graphics card in their shipping Mac Pro or high-end Pro machine.
And definitely.
The funny thing that they decided to pull is they were like, well, heck, if we're throwing in a serious graphics card, let's just throw in two of them for
well,
the heck
what
of
the
it.
Hell? What the hell?
Right? I mean, it's like, you know, it's really funny because for many years, Apple has been kind of criticized as having fairly poor GPU options in their configurations. There's never been a huge number of aftermarket graphics cards that you could add to them. There's always been a handful, but Apple, I guess, struck like the deal of the century with AMD. You may remember that AMD used to be the company that made graphics cards called ATI until AMD bought ATI. But these are now AMD Fire Pro graphics processors. And the Fire Pros are their Pro workstation class card. And I think it's because they wanted to both be able to draw lots of complicated stuff to the screen and rely on the graphics processor kind of under the hood to do a lot of the heavy mathematical calculation and lifting that our programs demand of us these days, that they're like, well, let's put two in because we've created this system. The main system that Apple and OS X use is called Grand Central Dispatch, and we can utilize available CPU processor cores and available GPU cores to do all manner of interesting, you know, calculations. So that could be a render, it could be doing real-time previews of graphical effects or transitions or whatnot. And so there's two of them in every config, but there's three options. And again, when all three of them come as a pair. So the three AMD pairs of GPUs that you can get in the Mac Pros are what are called the D300s, the D500s, and the D700s. They're all in the Fire Pro family.
And this would be an instance where actually more is better. You're gonna the more RAM you get in your GPU, the better.
So there's two things that define these GPUs as being different than one another. Most of our listeners are probably familiar with VRAM, right? Video RAM. This is memory that is on the graphics processor itself. It's not your general RAM. It's the RAM specific for your graphics card. And the D300 has, I want to say, yeah, it's two gigs per chip.
So that's four total. And then
the D500 has three, and the D700 has 6 gigs of VRAM per GPU, which is
unheard of.
I think the most VRAM that's probably ever been available on a Mac graphics card that I'm familiar with, maybe there were some aftermarket NVIDIAs that had 4 or 5, maybe somewhere up there, but this is a lot of VRAM if you do the D700s. And the other interesting thing is if you get this class of processor just, you know, as a PCI card for like a homebrew PC, they are like three times the cost of what Apple is charging as build to order options, even for those higher end GPU options, the 500 and the 700. So there's two factors I was mentioning, right? You've got the VRAM, and it is an important factor. This is huge if you're doing just very graphics heavy stuff, and it's really, really big when you get into the realm of 3D, both modeling and animation.
And I would also say, you know, this is definitely the place where in the realm of color correction, you can't go wrong, especially.
Absolutely.
If you are, you know, and the first interesting thing about color correction is a lot of times they see the fringes of newer codecs a lot before the rest of the industry does. Because the first thing, if somebody does a larger than 4K project, when they're done with it, they need somebody to full res color correct that. So
yeah, and that's a very intensive task.
It is. Frame by frame, you know what it takes, right? So it's an interesting dynamic. I had mentioned before CUDA cores, right? I had that question today, right? Folks who have previous iMacs or rather Mac Pros, and they got a CUDA core enabled card and they're using some flavor of Adobe. You know, what about that? Was Adobe involved? I mean, are we going to see the level of integration with CUDA core enabled GPU acceleration that we would in, now what do they call it? OpenCL?
Yeah, correct. So here's the deal, right? NVIDIA created a language for programmers to take advantage that allows them to what we call really write to the metal of the card. What that's kind of a way of saying is take advantage of the graphics processor at a very low programming level where they can muscle as much power out of the graphics processor as possible. And Adobe is a good example because they've had this thing called the Mercury GPU playback engine. And it is there to specifically use the graphics processor for a lot of the types of tasks that you might use in Photoshop, Premiere Pro, and After Effects, right? And so the thing about CUDA, this instruction set, is that it's NVIDIA specific, NVIDIA being the other main graphics card company other than AMD. And Apple has gone with AMD here, and CUDA is not a thing that exists with AMD cards. What Apple has been pushing for years is kind of an alternative to CUDA, similar in nature, called OpenCL. And it's actually, the word open is true. It's a little bit more of an open standard because different graphics card manufacturers can adopt it. I mean, even NVIDIA can adopt it if they want to on their cards. NVIDIA has chosen to really push CUDA more than anything. But Apple is really trying to encourage developers, write your apps using these OpenCL instruction sets, and you're going to be able to muscle a huge amount of power off of these AMD cards, even though they aren't technically CUDA-enabled. And so some apps today, we'll talk a little bit about the Final Cut update that happened today after we talk about the Mac Pros, but the latest Final Cut update that came out today is a good example. It's specifically written to take as much advantage out of that processing power in these GPUs as possible, but not every app is as optimized to use OpenCL. Some, frankly, aren't optimized at all to use OpenCL today.
Sure, and there are partnerships like Adobe, you know, they got a leg up on this. We'll see that integration fairly quickly.
Yeah, but Adobe has had Mac Pros in testing. Listeners will remember that we had Dave Helmley on, and he talked about Adobe having access to the Mac Pro for a while and making sure that they were optimizing their software around it. But
The norm is not. So
Well, it's a little mixed. I mean, some apps will inherently take advantage of the overall power of these processors and the fact that the higher end ones have gobs of VRAM. Some apps will just leverage that and behave well. When they optimize around OpenCL specifically, maybe more than they are today, or for some folks, one of our clients mentioned Blender today, and Blender is optimized for CUDA, Blender being kind of an open source community 3D rendering and modeling and animation package, and it supports CUDA, but I don't believe it supports OpenCL yet. Well, my feeling is Apple is such a big player in making workstation machines.
It'll happen.
That almost every developer is going to tweak their apps over the next 3, 6, 9 months and make sure they're leveraging the OpenCL libraries so their apps are as optimized for these pair of GPUs and these new Mac Pros as possible. And what we've seen with things like the new Final Cut, which some people we know saw kind of in beta, this new version, but what's possible when a developer takes the time to really write to these OpenCL libraries, we're seeing the type of stuff, a phrase I heard about someone I know who may have seen a Mac Pro a little while ago, running a possibly early version of Final Cut, the version that came out today, is that the amount of real-time just lifting that the machine can do now basically surpasses anything they'd ever seen before. And so
it's really impressive when you think about the fact that most folks right now are probably still white-knuckling a Mac Pro from 2007, you know?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And the reality is we haven't seen a significant Mac Pro upgrade in 4 or 5 years now. I mean, even the last major upgrade, which
wasn't really a major upgrade. It was a quiet, hey, you know, pat on the head.
It was nothing. It was nothing. So the last real one was like, what, 2009, 2010?
Prior to me beginning my employ here at Chesapeake Systems.
So, I mean, again, we're a little, this is like the olden days when Apple would release a new machine and it actually meant something, damn it. But so we're a little excited and a little worn out.
I'm very excited.
So, but in a nutshell, the GPUs, given their price point, given that Apple is not going insane, they must have leveraged an insane deal with AMD to get these chips in these machines at these prices. Go as high as you can, guys.
Absolutely.
Definitely take at least the middle of the road D500 option. Oh, I wasn't talking about, so the OpenCL instructions, one of the things GPUs also have cores. GPU cores work very differently than CPU cores, and one of the things that sets that off is that the number of cores in graphics processors is literally measured in many hundreds, if not thousands, of cores. They're much more specific. They involve shaders, and it's a much more specific type of basically math and processing that they're capable of than a CPU. But in addition to getting more VRAM, you get more GPU cores if you go up to the D500, and then even more if you go to the D700. So,
Do it.
Yeah. Just do the high end GPU.
And
if
while
you
you're at it, buy a Nikon D700 too.
Yeah, those are nice.
They are. So those are the two real, what I would say, X factor scenarios in the new Mac Pro. Everything else is we're kind of more familiar with. You know, a RAM. There is something different about the way in which the storage is presented, but you know, let's talk about that now. So,
we'll start with storage. So it's
I'm reading it and I'm saying PCIe. That's very interesting. I've never seen that as part of the descriptor of storage.
Well, and the other thing that's going to confuse people is they look at a phrase PCIe.
Think slots.
And
they
say,
cards.
Wait, I didn't think these Mac Pros had slots because PCIe or PCI Express is the type of PCI expansion card technology that we've used for many years when you slap a graphics video card or another graphics card or a capture card, whatever, into those slots that used to be on the Mac Pro. But don't be confused. The Mac Pros do not have expansion slots. P- PCIe is operating here essentially under the hood as the type of bus technology that the now completely flash storage-based storage unit is connected to internally under the hood.
I got a question for you about that then.
I got an answer for you.
Okay. Well, so, you know, that's a standard protocol that would be used over Thunderbolt as well, this PCIe.
Yes.
Typically, we're breaking, you know, there are instances where we can break that technology out into a chassis and all that other stuff. Are we seeing similar speeds?
Well,
external
storage so the reason Apple went to PCI Express under the hood is twofold. One, you're right to link it to Thunderbolt in that Thunderbolt is essentially PCIe shrunk down to a tiny little port, but it really is speaking the PCI Express protocol. So the PCI Express bus has to exist under the hood, but now, by actually putting the flash storage, this is your storage device, not RAM, but it's still flash-based, but by making it a PCI Express flash storage device, it used to be SATA, and that it would use like the SATA bus, which was slower than PCI Express under the hood. But this is not a SATA flash drive. This is a true bunch of flash storage directly on the PCI Express bus inside
the
of the machine.
The bullet train of that's a terrible analogy. Never mind.
Bullet trains are nice and
yeah.
fast. And I think
yeah.
they're kind of cool.
I mean, it's just like you're tapping right into
it. I support the bullet train
you do?
Reference. In
okay.
That. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great.
I rode the Shinkansen. That's
oh, yeah?
what the Japanese
sure.
call the bullet train over in Nihon. But man, that was cool. I wish the Acela just... was a
yeah,
little bit cooler.
I wish the Acela, what, took 14 minutes to get to New York instead of
I mean,
an hour?
I like the Acela. I go on it when I can. I'm kind of a train nerd. I think that we should have like this like 400-mile-an-hour maglev train between Boston
totally.
And Washington. But
totally.
You know,
and we'll outfit it with a bunch of Mac Pros.
You know, Joe Biden's a big train guy, and I
is
just
he?
He used to ride the Acela and Amtrak between Wilmington, Delaware, and D.C. when he was a senator. So
I thought you meant like I just imagined him like playing with trains on a table.
Well,
something.
It is, you know, Christmas is coming up, and he may bust out the old HO scale model train set. I wouldn't be surprised.
Okay,
I could
are you visiting this year, or are you just passing through?
Yeah. So anyway.
So bullet train.
But
it's basically just a straight shot.
PCI
into the...
Express is fast. Yes, straight shot. You're mainlining that storage right into the mother
That's
load
a good way. There. I accept that analogy as well. you know.
So think about it this way. The pipe between the single onboard drive, which is this flash storage device, and all of the other subsystems, the CPUs, the GPUs, the RAM, everything, is way bigger than it used to be. And the benchmarks that people are seeing for this built-in flash storage is basically over a gigabyte per second of transfer rates. And that is about 3 times as fast as previous generation flash storage devices. So if you're one of these people who you know, started using like a MacBook Air or a Retina MacBook Pro or even one of these iMacs with a flash startup drive and you're like, oh my God, I'm never going back to using a hard drive for my boot drive because this is just completely amazing and my computer starts in like 5 seconds and oh my God, this is the best. This is like 3 to 4 times
as fast. You
ain't
seen nothing yet.
This is 3 to 4 times as fast. Now the thing is, and here's where it gets into the decision-making process for our customers, you have 3 size options for the flash storage device, and flash is inherently not as big as traditional hard drives or even these hybrid fusion drives that Apple's been selling for a couple of years now because it's much more expensive, and you have basically the option of a 256 drive, 256 gigs, 512, or a terabyte. And, you know, terabyte's starting to get big, but that terabyte option adds many hundreds of dollars.
Sure. Definitely more expensive than a traditional SATA drive, you know.
Absolutely.
Comparable. And the thing to think about is there's really been a change in the paradigm and the way that people are working, right? It used to be I need, you know, a 4-drive RAID inside my Mac Pro for my scratch disk so that I can get everything going and I can do this, right? And now that's really been put on its head. And, you know, most folks are doing work through external drives or through external Thunderbolt devices or in lots of cases, we hope, some sort of networked SAN. But the thing about it that's different is, you know, you use your boot drive to get your OS to start up, your critical system files, maybe a local render. That's certainly faster. But in any other instance, the idea is that you would either have a Pegasus 2 or something else that's going to serve as
whether,
your storage.
Whether it's a little external desktop RAID drive that's connected via Thunderbolt, or whether you're connected to a SAN, full-on fiber channel SAN, like XSAN or StorNext, using a fiber channel Thunderbolt adapter, or even a file server. And the Mac Pros have a couple of gigabit Ethernet ports, and so maybe you're connected to a file server over gigabit, or maybe you've got one of Sonnet's 10 gig Ethernet Thunderbolt adapters, you know, slung off the back of this, and you're attached to a file server over 10 gig Ethernet, that you don't have to think of extra usable space very much being inside your pro workstation anymore.
I feel like, you know, 256 is a good place if you know you're never going to do a render. But to the middle of the ground, I'd say like a 500 gig drive is all you really need, because you're not going to want to save everything you do to your...
No, Google. In fact, you really want to think of that startup drive as being operating system, apps, and the helper files associated with the operating system and apps. And as you just said, frankly, even if you've got the whole Adobe Creative Cloud suite on there, you've got OS X, maybe you've got, you know, Final Cut Pro 10 on there, a few other things, you know, you may still be able to get away with a 256 drive. I think most of our customers will be very well served with a 512. Never a bad idea to buy yourself a little more headroom on your storage device. And, you know, we're not really that sure at this point if that PCI Express flash storage little daughter card that's on one of the boards in the Mac Pro, I keep wanting to call it a tower, but it's really not a tower anymore. It's a tube. But anyway, you know, we're not 100% certain at all, really, if that's ever going to be user replaceable. And there's a good chance that it will be, but that'll be probably an aftermarket part that someone like OWC or whatever puts out that might just void your warranty or something, and maybe isn't as optimized anyway. So kind of assume that that flash storage is what you're going to have for the time being. You're not going to expand it. The way to expand storage that's on board is through Thunderbolt devices, Thunderbolt RAIDs, or connections to network storage, as you were saying. And so I wouldn't limit myself to the 256 personally. I would do 512. And if for some reason I've got workflows that just demand doing as much as possible, as fast as possible locally, maybe the terabyte, but it's still just hard for me to justify that, because I think you're going to be better set up just to have a little external RAID connected via Thunderbolt.
Like, sure.
You were mentioning the promise Pegasus's...
Anyway, Promise has a Thunderbolt connected RAID.
we're just going to refer to it as the...
But so, speaking of that, really, the only other thing we have here is RAM, and I was actually a little surprised. There has been a trend from Apple in the last 2 years or so, and that's mostly on the iMac and the MacBook Pro side, but it's sort of integrated RAM. It's soldered RAM. It's, you know, choose what you want from the get-go, because, you know, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's been hit or miss, right? The MacBook Air really did not have user-replaceable RAM.
Never did.
The new MacBook Pro Retinas don't have user-replaceable RAM. The Mac Minis kind of have, but it's a real pain. Well, in the original Mac Minis, it was really hard to get in there. You needed to use a putty knife, or as Apple called it, the Mac Mini opening tool or whatever. You could actually buy that as an Apple service provider. You could buy the like Mac Mini opening tool device from Apple.
And then you could...
It literally was a putty knife that came in this really slick little Apple bag with all the nice little logo on it. And you're like... That's a frickin' putty knife that they picked up at the hardware store for like $1.59. What the hell, Apple?
You know,
we love you guys, though. Especially our dear departed Saint Steve.
Oh, we're calling him Saint Steve now?
Why not?
Yeah, sure.
There was that cover of The Economist where he was holding up the iPad and it was like the tablet and he had the aura and it was all that Christian...
I did see that, yeah.
...motif thing.
Yeah. But so, RAM, in this case, we're talking about a little more flexibility, quite frankly.
Yeah, you have four slots that you can get at. You can get at them. There's only four slots, though, which is a little weird, because with these dual CPU machines for the last bunch of years, you've either had six or eight RAM slots, and now you're down to four. And people are like, oh my goodness, that's going to really constrain the amount of random access memory that I can have in my workstation class computer. But
wow, that was the best Seth Green I ever heard.
So, you know, I saw him at the store in New York maybe 6 months ago. It's called Toy Tokyo.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
It's got all... This is like one of these really geek out places. I swear to God, I was just walking by. I'm not into this stuff. But
Nick was there with a map. He was circling sections, you know, he wanted to go to.
They have all these like Japanese like plastic vinyl monster toys that these very...
They're made out of something called PVC.
Very extreme, strange, weird individuals that you never want to associate with or buy any of your advanced video technology from might happen to be into as collectors. But anyway.
Who are they?
So Seth Green was in there. I'm like, you know what? I'm picturing Robot Chicken. And he like is figuring out what he's going to do for the next episode of Robot Chicken with these weird like monster figures. And I don't know. I thought that was cool.
It is. And then of course, we're selling all the new storage to Robot Chicken for the next season. I wish. But you did talk to him though, right?
I think we have talked to them actually.
Yeah. But, we should say hello. But hi, Seth, if by chance you're listening.
So anyway, RAM. I don't know. Yeah, that was quite the diversion. Even for us, that was a bit of a diversion,
wasn't it?
So any RAM, right? And again, people sometimes, even our dearest customers, sometimes call their storage device their memory. But really, here in the biz, when you've reached a certain level of geekdom, you really are referring to the RAM chips as your memory, the random access memory. And quick frame of reference.
They all play Daft Punk.
What? Oh, Rant, that's an album. I get it. Sorry. Took me a second, and I'm kind of a Daft Punk fan, so yeah. I was like, what the heck? Anyway.
Be sure to play Get Lucky on the outro.
Yeah. Just don't let anyone who's like a copyright infringement person from the MPAA or whatever listen to this episode.
Right.
Filter their IP addresses.
If we get a cease and desist, it's going to be from Seth Green.
I know, right? So anyway, your storage device is your long-term memory. It's what stores all the data. Your RAM is what is holding all of the data that you're kind of dealing with at a given moment. All of the data that's being processed, the data associated with the operating system and the applications that are running there and then. And the fact of the matter is, we used to not be able to take very much advantage of lots of RAM because everything was 32 bits. And one of the aspects of 32-bit computing was that individual threads actually could really only use 2 gigs of RAM at once. And so like Final Cut 7 could maybe use like, a couple of gigs. Well, nowadays all of our apps are 64-bit. And one of the advantages of that is that they can literally use as much RAM as you can possibly throw at them basically. And so RAM is one of those areas where more, AKA bigger, is better in basically every circumstance.
You know, you mentioned something about Final Cut 7 and this is a good time to sort of remind folks, are you still using Final Cut 7? Are you on an old Mac Pro? Do you know where your children are? Well, it's 10 o'clock. You should probably figure that out. But the truth of the matter is...
We're in Hamden, dude. There's like four-year-olds running around at 1 a.m.
Yeah, like, you won't know when the zombie apocalypse comes here because you can't tell whether or not it's just a kid running in the street or not. But, jeez. I live here too, by the way, folks, just so we're clear.
Meryl literally lives around the corner from the office, so when Dash is like 4 years old, I'm going to keep an eye on him.
Yeah. I'm not going to be that guy. But so, Final Cut 7, right?
We don't even know if Final Cut 7 is going to perform well on these machines.
This is something to really think about, right? Maybe you're holding on for a while, but, Nick said something that really just sort of like cuts the core, from an editor perspective. If you're still using Final Cut 7, then you are only utilizing 2 gigs of RAM, no matter how much you got in that Mac Pro. Forget like the hard sell. You are going to see one hell of a difference. You're going to see one hell of a difference if you go from a 32-bit Final Cut 7 application on, let's say, a 2007 or 2008 Mac Pro to a new Mac Pro.
With either Premiere Pro or Creative Cloud Premiere Pro Final Cut 10. It's going to cut like butter.
It'll blow your mind, man.
Speaking of Final Cut 10, I think that's probably a great place to segue.
Well, let me say just one more quick thing about the RAM.
All right. Not a great place to segue then.
We're almost there. There's only 4 RAM slots. The good news is RAM chips go up to, as of today, 16 gigs of RAM per chip. So you can actually, as of today...
64?
That is 16 times 4, Meryl. Very good.
I can do math.
Very good.
They taught me when they hired me here.
We had to get Meryl to stop closing deals at negative profit margins, but it took a little remedial arithmetic.
It's all right. It's all right. These days...
Some of our customers really benefited from that. But anyway... because the RAM chips available today are up to 16 gigs each, you know, you can fill all four slots with 16 gig chips, get a total of 64, and have gobs and gobs of RAM, and your system and all of your apps in the operating system will use it. Now, Apple's pricing for the 16 gig option and the 32 gig option, 32 gig obviously using four 8 gig chips, not bad pricing. There are third-party RAM manufacturers with very high-quality RAM that we do sometimes do business with that have a little better pricing, mayhaps, than Apple on especially that 64-gig version.
Sure.
So, you know, I'd say it's difficult for me to imagine myself ever selling one of my clients a Mac Pro with any less than 32 gigs, and 32 will be a lot. You're in good shape with 32.
Sure.
But if you can go for 64, and let's say you're a hardcore After Effects user and you're doing a lot of, like, I guess, the RAM renders and all that stuff and just things that eat mad RAM, go for the 64. It's not a bad option. 32 is probably, which is really the mid option. You know, it's funny. Apple makes a 12 gig configuration available, and that's basically using 3 4-gig chips, but unless I'm mistaken, that's not going to actually utilize the RAM as effectively as possible, because the RAM won't be running in quad channel mode unless you actually have all four slots filled. So don't think about a configuration.
Yeah, don't get 12 gigs of RAM as well.
Just fill all four slots, whether it's 4-gig chips, 8-gig chips, or 16-gig chips. Fill all four. Try to shoot for 32 as your baseline. If you can do it, do the 64. You will be happy. And the other thing to point out is, we don't know this yet. This is kind of a theory, but it could be that when 32 chips roll out, there's a chance that these Mac Pros will support them. And if that happens, and you fill your machine with what are probably going to be quite expensive 32 gig chips, and you
put
four
of them.
These machines may end up supporting 128 gigs of RAM. So it remains to be seen. The reality is that.
Do you have any idea how much reality television you can cut with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's probably an overkill thing for most folks, but just throwing it out there that it might be interesting to keep an eye on that and see if they end up supporting those larger chips when they become available. But the reality is 32 is going to serve right almost all of our clients, and 64 is just, you know, you won't feel RAM starved ever, basically. And those are the four things, right? We went over
them. There is something else I want to mention, and actually I didn't even think about it today until we sat down and started putting together some of the first proposals for folks who have been, you know, patiently waiting for, like,
are you going to mention the keyboard and mouse?
I was, and I was also going to mention the monitor too. You know,
this
is something to think about, right? So there are no, in your build to order configurations, it's not part of the system to get a keyboard and a mouse.
Yeah, so basically Apple
is like a Mac Mini scenario.
Apple's kind of doing what they've done with the Mini for a while, where, you know, if you want a keyboard and mouse, either stick with the ones you got, or we can put separate ones on there. And whether you do Apple ones or third party ones, just bear in mind, when you open up that cool, slick Mac Pro box, which, do you think it's going to be a tube-shaped box? How cool would that be?
I think it might be, because if you look at the new iMac boxes they've been shipping for the last year, they did away with, like, the external, like, printing, and they made them slender so that they
would... You know, it's a really funny question. Is a tube-shaped box still a box when it's not inherently boxy because it's a tube? But then you think of a hat box, and hat boxes tend to be kind of round and tubular. And they're a box because it's called a hat box. So it's just weird. If it's a tubular box, I'm going to keep thinking I'm using the wrong word for it when I describe it.
Will you play some tubular bells when he says tubular box?
So anyway, there's not going to be a keyboard or a mouse or a magic trackpad or anything
in
there.
Sure. You got to think about that. And then, of course, the video output, you got some options here. It does have an HDMI on it.
One HDMI, so it's almost like the new MacBook Pros with Retina or whatnot that have had an HDMI port for a little while. And it's
Then six Thunderbolt. You know, you can go
six
Thunderbolt
Thunderbolts. There's I think three or four USB 3.0 ports. There's a couple of gigabit Ethernet ports. There's no real, the funny thing is, too, there's no real shortage of expansion on the new Mac Pros. It's just external. And that, may be a little bit of a sea change for people who are used to having most of those peripherals inside that big silver box.
Sure.
I think it's kind of nice to have a lot of them external, because it's so easy then to swap between machines. And maybe you go out on a shoot and you want to bring your little video card that's a Thunderbolt device or a little Thunderbolt RAID. you know, it's pretty easy to just like pop it out and bring your laptop with you and plug it into that, and voila, you've got that stuff. And that
it's almost like you really have one workstation and two modular pieces.
Exactly,
you know? And,
exactly.
And the idea of having a centralized workstation where I do this kind of work here, really, you know, if I got a MacBook Pro Retina in the field and I got a, you know, or I'm a DIT in the field and I got to do a certain level of ingest, or, you know, I got to do any of that stuff, I might have all these things that normally I have hooked up to my desktop and throw them in my bag, you know, get a couple battery chargers and go out for a full day of production and do all that offload and not have to potentially invest in. And then
a second set,
which could drive my rates up, my daily rates, which could upset a producer who may or may not want to hire me as a result. And then I'm out of a job.
Yeah. The other thing, though, and I understand some people's complaint.
Buy Mac Pros.
You know, a lot of people are saying, like, well, what about cable management? There's going to be all these cables sticking out of the back of my Mac Pro. Those Thunderbolt connectors don't have any kind of locking mechanism. The USBs don't have any locking mechanism. And I'm going to just throw this out there that cable management is something that people may have to be a little more aware of with these. If they do start building a collection of external peripherals, I expect to see lots of really nifty third-party things.
There's going to be some aftermarket spaghetti junction evaluating, sort of put it together and make it nice and clean. You know, it always happens. When you know, it'll fit the footprint somehow of the machine. It'll line up. It'll look nice aesthetically, and then you can just handle all your cables.
But it is something to be aware of, and I think that's the trade-off. That, you know, there is no locking mechanism with Thunderbolt, so you don't want to
pulling on the Thunderbolt cable.
You don't want to set these things up in a place where you're going to be tripping over the Thunderbolt cables constantly and yanking them out of the back of the Mac Pro. That's not good. But and the other thing I'll throw out too, you know, many of our clients who do use SANs, you know, are used to having a fiber channel card inside the machine, and that was just something we spec'd out their Mac Pros with. Well, now you're more than likely going to use an external Thunderbolt fiber channel adapter. We've typically sold the ones that Promise makes. Sonnet also makes some. But your interface to a high-performance SAN or even NAS environment is now going to be an external little box. So it is something to just be aware of.
Sure, yeah. You know, it's ultimately, it'll cost you the same, I think, at the end of the day. It's just a matter of where it is in the chain.
Now, you were talking about monitors, and because both the Thunderbolt ports and the HDMI port, the new flavor of HDMI that the Mac Pro offers, can support 4K resolutions. And you can have up to three 4K monitors connected across the Thunderbolt ports and HDMI port. It's like there is no, as of today, new 4K Apple display.
There isn't. And just as an aside, you can have up to six 27-inch Thunderbolt displays hooked
if
up.
If you really feel like doing a video wall or something.
If you feel like spending the $1,000 per each screen.
Exactly. But, you know, the good news is we here at Chesapeake offer variety of manufacturers' screen products, and that would include 4K displays from folks like, I don't know.
I think there's a Dell one out there.
People are starting to roll them out.
You're going to see them, and they're not going to, you know, there's not going to necessarily be a compelling reason to go with an Apple flavor 4K resolution.
But,
versus
the Apple ones tend to be nice. It's not out yet. They haven't announced any such thing. We are not rumor mongering, listeners who happen to work for Apple Inc. But, you know, inevitably more and more 4K displays are going to start to hit the market. They might connect with DisplayPort, Mini DisplayPort, HDMI. Just know that your new Mac Pro will be fully ready for the 4K display.
And it'll also handle, just to put it out there, there are consumer 4K monitors that are out now in Best Buy. You can buy them this holiday season. Those potentially, via HDMI, you can have that 4K display.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if some folks decide to do that for, you know, kind of quality assurance monitoring, even though those aren't obviously graded displays with perfect calibration, not by a long shot, as maybe a client monitor, a consumer 4K display. If you're doing 4K projects, just plugged right into that HDMI port, could work potentially quite well.
Something to think about.
So listen, we've gone over the ins and outs of the new Mac Pro. Obviously, folks, we do sell these things. We do expect there to be some lead time, but if you want to get a quote or whatnot, yeah, we'd sure like it if you could
call the boys at Chesapeake Systems. We'll sort you out.
Out. But something else happened today. We've alluded to it a few times. We kind of knew it was coming in tandem with the Mac Pro. But today, Apple released the sort of weirdly named Final Cut Pro 10 10.1. And that's the first 10 was an X, of course, because it's a Roman numeral, but it is a 10. It's not an X. And then the second one is the actual number of the app, 10.1. And folks who have transitioned over into Final Cut 10 land already have seen a bevy of updates over the last couple of years, some of them very significant. In fact, Final Cut 10 really almost getting back into, from a sheer feature perspective, where Final Cut 7 was at. You know, a lot of people's initial complaints about Final Cut 10, the reality is Apple's put just about all of those capabilities back into the app.
I'd say we're at about 80% now, and what, it took 2.5?
You know, I'd almost...
70%?
I'd almost say more than that. No, no. I'd say almost more. I mean, for the types of workflows that we see today, you know, I could name, probably counting on one hand, clients of mine that still ingest baseband video off of a live feed or a tape to their workstation directly. I mean, it's very uncommon. We're working with files these days.
It's it's all files, and, you know, it's just the odd analog I.O. these days.
And so Final Cut doesn't do the actual video ingest using, like, a Kona card. It can monitor out, but it can't ingest. And you know what? Kona cards, Blackmagic cards, they just come with those apps. So it's not really that hard to get video off of a tape and turn it into a file, so then Final Cut 10 can use it. But most of the other features, there hadn't been a separate, like, preview and canvas window before. There were, you know, didn't do video monitoring originally. There was a whole lot of features. Well, the reality is, yesterday, most of them were baked back into the $299 application, which is cheaper than almost any plugin any of you probably have. So you might want to just consider having it because it's a really good piece of software now. But today, 10.1 came out. And while that sounds like a very minor update, back in the day, that would have been more like the difference between Final Cut 6 and Final Cut 7. So this 10.1 is significant. And the biggie is that it's highly, highly optimized to work with the multiple GPUs in the brand new Mac Pro.
4K is where it's at. You know, these guys really, you know, if you look at it from a two-year perspective, they really hit their stride. A lot of people said that Apple had sort of lost their head in, you know, FCPX, but it's clear, I think, now, looking at the 2 years that have passed since the product came out, they had a clear vision. And it took some time.
They didn't handle it very smoothly. You know, the interesting thing is one of their other pro apps, Logic, the audio application that they bought from eMagic.
Sure.
I think they learned from how they kind of mangled the Final Cut transition, because with Logic, there hadn't been a lot of updates for like a couple of years, but they didn't just stop selling the existing version. And when they released the like fully rewritten version of Logic Pro, it had all of the capabilities that the previous version had. It didn't feel like they had just, you know, eviscerated it in the process, kind of like a lot of people felt they did with Final Cut 10. So I think Apple learned, and they never really intended to tick people off quite as badly as they did. And they learned from it because they handled it very differently with Logic. But now that 10.1 is out, you know,
you almost can get rid of that. You know, I think it's almost like out of fashion to say that it's you know, like a fancy iMovie. It's back to...
Yeah, no, it's a hardcore professional application, and a lot of what we're hearing from, again, folks who have used it heavily both up till now and folks who have given us hints about what it's behaving like, especially on this new Mac Pro hardware, is that from a sheer performance standpoint, it's probably the fastest nonlinear editor on the market right now. That's even if you're dealing with native Red code, which, yes, it handles natively.
It does.
So they, in fact, today they announced support for MTS files if you're shooting the AVC HD codec. There's a long, long list of features that they brought out today. The big one, of course, just overall performance enhancements. Lots of additional little features as far as like, setting audio fade points on audio tracks in the sequence. There's so many little things that really, I think, get it back there to being what people need it to be. But another really interesting one, and this is going to demand a little bit of play to really understand the dynamic, is there's now this additional level of organization called the library. And so whereas before you had your project, which really was your sequence, and you had your events, which are very analogous in many ways to an Avid bin, which is a location in on a folder somewhere, but also with a little bit of a database in there, you know, to store information about like your subclips and things like that, your keyword ranges or whatever they call subclips these days. But now there's this thing that kind of can reference both multiple sequences, aka projects, and events, allow you to turn events on and off. This was a big complaint a lot of people had, because they were like, gosh, I don't want a client who's looking over my shoulder to see every event that I've created for every other project and see who else I'm working with. That's none of their business. Sometimes it's a conflict of interest. And so it just seems like Apple's given a lot more flexibility to the users now to just manage all of the stuff that they're working on in terms of both sequences and the clips themselves, the events folders. We understand from some of the MAM developers that we work with, the media asset management systems, that this new version 10.1 of Final Cut is potentially a lot more intelligent and feature-rich at interacting with other types of collaborative software platforms like a media asset management system. And so I'm very excited to learn over the coming days and weeks what this is going to mean,
sure,
both for individual users and more sophisticated work groups, because if some of this ends up making it a much more flexible editing tool, you know, between...
You might be having a much more flexible, you know, sand environment as a result.
Yeah, because, you know, Final Cut 10 wasn't always the nicest player in collaborative storage environments. It wasn't always the nicest player with media asset management systems. Now, I have some hope that we're going to see additional levels of collaboration,
sure,
and just overall sophistication when it comes to that stuff. So check it out. Again, Final Cut 10 is like $299, folks. It's cheaper than most like basic effects that you would get from like Red Giant or whatever. So
And truth of the matter is, I mean, like I think most editors have a copy of it on their machine and maybe use it once in a blue moon, but it's the kind of tool set at $300 where why the hell not? I mean, you know,
and we can't even sell it to you,
yeah,
so we don't have a vested interest,
yeah,
here. Apple totally, you know.
Yeah, you got to get it through the App Store.
Tore that out from our us resellers and basically decided to go
we
direct.
We can just sell,
right,
you the hardware, which we're happy to do. And we're happy to sell you, you know, Creative Cloud and what else you need here to round out that workstation so that you have every editing tool that you need on one brand spanking new 12-core Mac Pro.
Yeah, boy.
That's right. Drop the mic.
So, we've really hit it a lot today. We talked about the Mac Pro. Orders are taking place. We can spec them out for you, offer additional feedback on how to configure these for your needs, put the orders in, then we're all going to like sit patiently for like a month or two while we're waiting for these things to arrive, and just every day we'll have dreams about black tubular Mac Pros. And, you know, eventually they'll get here. The new Final Cut landed.
And then everything's good.
I'll tell you, this is like one of those old school Apple days, like,
yeah,
5-6 years ago, where there'd be like a new Mac Pro or a new laptop that dropped, and we'd all like sit around in front of the computer and like memorize every spec. Of course, this was what I was doing at like 3 a.m. last night when I couldn't sleep. So, you know, I guess it was a lot of pent up urge.
I see.
Right?
I see. I'll just leave with this thought, which is that, leading up to the release of this product, the number one question that I've received, and I think you probably have too, Nick, is what about my Thunderbolt workflow? And that's probably the thing that's the most nebulous still as a result of the fact that us not having the workstations in our hand. That's something that we can help you with. We can figure out what's going on there, what you need in line to make your color correction, ingest, external storage, connection to the SAN.
Monitoring,
monitoring, all those things that typically were once upon a time built into the Mac Pro but are now sort of modularized. We can help you.
And we've got it because we've been doing it for iMacs and for laptops that have just had Thunderbolt for ages. And, you know, we basically know what the lay of the land is going to be for the Mac Pro. So thanks for listening, guys. I hope you're as excited as we are. It's a whole new era for us professional Macintosh people.
Merry Mac Promise to you.
Merry Mac Promise to each and every one of us.
Oh, and happy Mac-a-days and...
Mac Kwanzaa?
Yeah.
Mackie New Year?
Pro Konica. Mac Pro Konica.
Okay.
Yes. All right.
As always, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, you just want to tell us how silly we are, you can email us at
SethGreen@Chessa.com.
WorkflowShow@Chessa.com. That's WorkflowShow@Chessa.com. You can reach us out to Merrill and I as far as the Chesapeake system side of stuff at ProSales@Chessa.com. We look forward to hearing from you guys, and stay tuned for next time. Take care.
See ya.